This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. And back when I was in elementary school, we knew all that you needed to know about what made up the world. Our science teachers told us everything was made of atoms, which in turn were made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Really, that's all we needed to know. Since then, our body of knowledge got larger while the parts of the atom got smaller. And one of the tiny subatomic particles not found in my seventh grade science book is the neutrino. Research out of NC State has discovered something fascinating about neutrinos. They can be used to communicate. Neutrinos, it seems, are shy, maybe a little self-conscious about their size. They are very, very small, and they don't have much in the way of charisma. In fact, neutrinos have no charge at all. But the fact that they pass through the world unnoticed makes them ideal candidates for carrying messages to hard-to-reach places like submarines or very distant spaceships. Physics Today magazine recently named the finding one of the top 10 breakthroughs of 2012. The research was led by scientists from North Carolina State University and the University of Rochester in New York. Dan Stansel is here. He's head of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at NC State, and he is one of the researchers on this project. Welcome, Dan. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And in the time that I read that introduction, several billion neutrinos pass through our bodies, so they are small.
That's right. From the sun, we're irradiated by probably more than a trillion per second through our bodies.
They're small. And what are they?
Well, they are subatomic particles, as you mentioned. They are in the same class as electrons. Like electrons, they are considered to be fundamental. That is, they aren't made up of other particles put together. But unlike the electron, again, as you said, they don't have charge. They don't have spin. They are thought to have a small mass, but the mass is perhaps a millionth that of an electron. And so when you put all that together, there just aren't many ways for the particles to interact with matter, and that gives rise to this unusual property that they can just zip right through the Earth without interacting with anything.
And that is useful in communications because we use electromagnetic waves that bounce off of stuff and makes it hard to get around the world, and it makes it hard to get, for instance, to submarines through all that water. And so that makes communication using these traditional means not so good. So what made you think the neutrino could be used, and how would it be used to solve that problem?
The idea of using neutrinos for communications is actually pretty old. The neutrino itself was discovered in 1956, and by the early 1970s, there were already some serious scientific proposals, as well as at least one science fiction proposal for using neutrinos for communications. And one of the first ideas was recognizing that you could send signals from point to point through the Earth or to reach submarines when they're so deep that electromagnetic waves can't reach them. Scientists had also thought about the possibility, and this was started with science fiction, but people have also considered it more seriously as well, about the possibility of doing interstellar communication with neutrinos because they won't be blocked by dust clouds where other types of signaling would have trouble getting through.
So the good news is nothing stops them. They very rarely run into anything that's going to make them bounce.
Exactly.
Bad news is nothing stops them, and they very rarely run into anything that will bounce, make them bounce, which means you could send the message, but you have to detect it on the other end, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. The thing that makes them interesting from a communications point of view also makes them very challenging. And really the only way that they interact is there is a very slight possibility that they will scatter off a proton in an atom. And when they do, then there is a shower of particles that you can see or can detect, sometimes with things like a flash of light or other types of detectors. So the strategy is to create a beam of neutrinos that's as intense as possible and then send that beam through as large a detector, as massive a detector as possible to maximize the likelihood that one of the neutrinos is going to collide with one of the protons and create a shower that you can see.
Well, this is quite an undertaking. So tell us how you did it.
Well, the experiment was done at Fermilab, and I want to emphasize that this really was a collaboration. It was a collaboration of over 100 scientists and engineers. It takes that sort of collaboration to do an experiment like this. The experiment at Fermilab used the Minerva neutrino experiment. And the Minerva experiment is designed to look at the differences between neutrino interactions with different types of atoms, different types of materials. And it uses the world's one of the world's most intense neutrino beams. Then the detector is over 100 tons and is 100 meters underground, about 1 kilometer away from the source of the neutrinos. One of my former students, who's now an engineer at NASA Glenn, was looking at the website one day, and it occurred to him, we had been talking about ways of communicating using particles other than light and radio waves, that it was possible perhaps to demonstrate that the source was intense enough and the detector sensitive enough that perhaps after many decades it may be possible to actually demonstrate that this was possible. And
I want to talk a little bit about how you do it, because it's fascinating to me. I mean, in order to get this beam of neutrinos to generate it, because the sun's doing it all the time, but it's hard to focus the sun. You know, you cannot get it to focus. I've tried magnifying glass now and then. So the idea is that you and tell me how much of this is wrong. You take an atom, or is it a proton, and you whip it around a track that's like 2.5 miles around, and then you bust it up, and now you've got some neutrinos that you can send off and in a beam.
Yes, that's basically the idea. There are a sequence of a couple of different accelerators. It starts off, I believe, as a linear accelerator, but then and proton, you are accelerating protons, just as you said, and then the last stage, they are circulated around a circular track to an energy of about 120 billion electron volts. An electron volt is the energy that a proton would get if it accelerated through 1 volt of potential. So that's very high energy. And then that beam is smashed into a carbon target. As a result of that collision, a shower of other particles come off that are unstable. And as they decay, many of them decay into neutrinos that go off in the same direction. And then that that there is a hollow decay pipe that's about 675 meters long, that is in which those particles decay into neutrinos, and then out the other end, the neutrinos continue on their way.
All right, so that's how you make a beam, but you've got another problem you want to communicate. That means you've got to make a message, and you want it to be picked up on the other end. So tell us about that.
That's right. The way the accelerator in the experiment was designed is to send pulses about once every 2.2 seconds. And the 2.2 seconds is needed because that's how long it takes to accelerate the protons up to the energy that you need. From a communications point of view, one way that you could put information on that is to turn the pulses on and off. It's sort of the simplest way that you could think of. And since the machine was not engineered to do communications, but rather particle physics, that seemed to be the wisest way to go forward. So what we did was we took the word neutrino and we turned it into a code of ones and zeros that was 40 ones and zeros long, length of 40 bits. And then my colleague at NC State, Brian Hughes, encoded it with a code that's used in deep space communications with NASA, added some redundancy that made it about 92 bits long. And that signal then was transmitted over and over for about 2.5 hours during the test of the experiment between the source and the detector.
And your receiver read it, and it flashed neutrino. Was it plural or singular?
Well, it was singular.
I would have gone singular because, you know, the less information, the better on the first run. That's all I'm thinking.
Well, no, it was singular, but the intent was plural. And there's a little bit of a funny story behind that, because when we were thinking, well, what should the first message be? We were thinking, well, there's a famous story about the first communication with a telegraph that was something like, "What hath God wrought?" And we thought, well, the answer to that would be neutrinos, and plural would make more sense. We created two files, one with the encoded neutrino and the other with the encoded word neutrinos. And the one neutrino was sent by mistake instead of neutrinos.
Yeah, so you made a mistake right off the bat, but it read it, and that's the good news. And just to explain how this works, you do this code, so it's zeros and ones. We kind of understand that in digital code, on, off, right? Either it reads a neutrino or not. And you did this by simply turning the accelerator on and off. So you're hoping that at least one of these neutrinos bangs into your receiver, and if it does, it's going to read it, and that's on. And then if there's an interval long enough, it reads that as no neutrino and decodes it, and it spells out neutrino at the end.
That's right. That's exactly right. The interesting thing about this type of code is you virtually never make a mistake when you send a zero, but you can make mistakes when you send a one, because sometimes the expected number of events was 0.8 in our experiment, which means that many times, even though neutrinos were sent, and in our case about 10 billion per pulse, there may not be any events. And when that occurs, then you've made an error. And so part of the strategy with encoding this was the redundancy, and this is commonly used in communication systems, is to add some redundancy in such a way that if you make a couple of mistakes, you can still reconstruct what the message was.
You kind of tell your receiver to look for this kind of thing, and it's filtering for some of that error.
That's right. Or you can tell that there was an error and figure out how to correct it.
So tell us about the possible applications. I guess submarine communication is the first that comes to mind, right?
Submarine was one of the most, I think, was the earliest and I think probably one of the most serious possibilities. This clearly is not going to replace Wi-Fi in your home. but the interesting thing about submarines is that, as you pointed out, when a submarine is operating at depth, then electromagnetic waves really can't penetrate the water. But neutrinos would have no trouble doing that. Now, one of the difficulties with a neutrino system is that you have to have a very massive detector to increase the likelihood that one of the neutrinos will collide with a proton and create something that you'll see. And in the case of the submarines, you can use the water around the submarine. So you can imagine covering the submarine shell with sensors, looking at the tons of water around it for signs that a collision has taken place. There was a physicist at Virginia Tech a couple of years ago, Patrick Huber, who did an updated assessment with current and projected technologies, and his analysis indicates that it should be possible to construct a system where you could get between 1 and 10 bits per second to any place on the globe using a neutrino communication
system. Because right now we should point out how you talked about a 2.5-hour experiment, but how long did it actually take your message to get through?
Right. Once we analyzed the data and took into account the error correction, we concluded that we were sending at a rate of 0.1 bits per second. Now, if you're sending 40 bits of information, basically, that means that it will take you about 6.5 minutes to send the word neutrino.
All right.
So this is not terribly fast.
You want to speed that one up, right?
But you can imagine that it could be significant for the mission of a submarine, for example, if there was no other way to communicate.
How do you tell your detector to ignore all the other billions of neutrinos that are headed its way?
There are several possible ways. One is that the natural neutrinos will have different energies, and you know the energy or the range of energies with which your beam transmitted, and so you can look for that. But in addition, you would also have an idea of what direction the neutrinos were coming from. So when you looked for the event and you saw this shower of particles coming off the collision, the direction of those scattered particles will tell you the direction from which the beam came. And then you can say, okay, I'm looking for a beam that's only in this direction, so I'm going to ignore anything that might happen that's coming from a different direction.
Now, you used a lot of unique, very big and very expensive to make this, so I'm guessing we're a little ways off from an actual practical application. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I would guess perhaps some decades away from building a practical system. And a lot of that would have to do with not only advances in science, but a decision that would be that there is a strong enough, compelling strategic need to focus the resources on it. But I would imagine that we're talking some decades before a system would be built.
But it's interesting that this is really the first time we've demonstrated that it can be done, even though we've been thinking about it for several decades now, ways to do it. And I guess you also, you talked about scientists and designers and engineers being involved. This essentially, at the moment, is an engineering problem. There is no new science in this particular discovery.
That's correct. It made use of properties of neutrinos that are known and communications theory that's known. And so the novel part of it is putting it all together and showing that you could, in fact, build a communications system using neutrinos. And as you said, it in some sense was a landmark event because even though people have been talking about it since the late 60s or early 70s, this was the first time that it was really possible to do it.
And that has the effect of focusing scientists and engineers in a particular direction instead of looking kind of 360 for the answer to this. So that does save you a lot of time in the long run if you're looking for this solution.
Well, it was an interesting collaboration, and it was unusual, I think, in the sense that particle physicists and communications engineers usually don't collaborate so closely. And so I think that was also one of the things that was particularly interesting about the project.
Less likelihood of you two bumping into each other than, let's say, a neutrino and an atom. And yet it happened. Fantastic. Great to talk with you, Dan.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dan Stanzel, head of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at NC State. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on the web, stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Wendt, Nicole Campbell, Dave DeWitt. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.